Jim Nicolai joined the North Dakota Attorney General's office in February 2017 to work as the Deputy Solicitor General in the Civil Litigation Division, where he represents the state and its agencies in federal and state court. Before joining the Attorney General's office, Jim clerked for both Judge Kermit Bai and Judge Myron Bright in the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, as well as Judge Rodney Webb at the United States District Court for the District of North Dakota. He was involved in the briefing for North Dakota Legislative Assembly v. Burgum, which Jim is presenting on today. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Before I get started, I just wanted to apologize on Wayne's behalf that he was unable to be here after this event got scheduled from the spring till now because of the pandemic. And he doubly wanted to apologize that I was the one that he had to send to replace him. And then the other thing, I see my timer is going to black out on my phone, so I'll have to watch up there, I guess. Before I get started, too, I wanted to thank Seth O'Neill from our office. I'm a little bit technology challenged, as many people from my office could tell you. When I can't PDF a file or I screw the printer up, and Seth was good enough to help me put together this PowerPoint and search the Google and the clip art for some of the illustrations. What I want to do before I get to the case itself is talk a little bit about the story behind the case. And where that story starts, interestingly enough, after following Judge Sutton and Justice Tufte talk about North Dakota state constitutions, is a provision of the North Dakota state constitution, in my opinion. This is the story behind the story starts here. And that provision is found in Article 4, Section 7, and it says, no regular session of the legislative assembly may exceed 80 natural days during the biennium. In other words, North Dakota has selected a biennial legislative system, which means the legislature only meets every 2 years. It can space them those 80 days out, but every 2 years it only has 80 days to do its business. Well, what does that have to do with this case? Well, think about it. If we had to pay our bills and plan for all our contingencies in just the 80-day period for the next 2 years, what practical problems that could create? The furnace goes out, you need a new refrigerator, you have flat tires on your car, you need a new engine, you have unexpected medical bills. So many things can happen in a 2-year period. And that's the practical problem that a biennial legislature has. And think about all of the services that are provided by the state and all the expenses and all the money. So many things, the Department of Transportation, Department of Human Services, the state doesn't operate only 80 days a year. It operates year-round. And there's all kinds of things that can happen. A tow truck or a plow can go out. The state can get a huge expense in litigation. So many things. And so we can't just go around and give every state agency one of these things with a pocket of money in it and say, oh, in case something comes up, there's your money. The legislature has to plan. And, you know, as North Dakotans, we pride ourselves on being practical. So what did we do about this problem, this practical problem? Well, it starts in 1965, and I don't know if you can see the date up there. But the legislature decided that we better create what they called a budget committee. So they passed this resolution in 1965, and then the next year that became a reality. With one of the responsibilities of this committee to report to the director of the budget. Flash forward now 5 years later, and by then we actually have two budget committees, Budget Committee A and B. And there were enough things, you know, to do to control the budget, to help with the budget, that they had created two subcommittees. And in 1971, they said, well, we have these two smaller budget committees. Some things are important enough. We want the whole group to come together. And they called that combined budget section committees, or combined budget committees, a budget section. And that's where we have that term come from, called the budget section committee. And then there are many things that happened from 1971 up through 2017 before this lawsuit between the governor and the Legislative Assembly. At least 21 different provisions, by my count, required some sort of budget section approval for payment of appropriated funds or other substantive matters in already existing legislation. And this screen just gives four of those examples. In game and fish spending, if there's going to be an amount that reduces the ballot below the balance of game and fish's budget below $15 million, it requires authorization by the budget section. Purchase of lease or aircraft without specific authorization from the Legislative Assembly or the budget section. Investments by the Board of University and School Lands cannot occur without prior approval of the Legislative Assembly or the budget section. All of these examples are found throughout North Dakota statutes and require some sort of budget section approval during that period between when the legislature is in session and when it's not. But this wasn't all clear skies. There was a storm brewing from that date on and all those statutes. And the three attorney generals between 1985 and present were all asked at various times, hey, is this something the budget section has the ability to do? And the first of those was, boy, I can't read this. In 1987, Attorney General Spaeth got asked whether the director of the budget, the director of budget shall reduce affected budgets by percentage sufficient to confer the estimated losses caused by the initiative or referendum action, subject to the approval of the budget section. And the Attorney General was asked, well, is that something that the budget section can do? And the short answer is that there exists a substantial question whether the role reserved by the legislature in executing that statute impermissibly usurps executive functions and violates fundamental separation of power principles, and goes on to discuss specifically the budget section's ability to disapprove or veto cuts altogether. And not to get into the meat of it, but the long and short of this is, you know, if this is a legislative function that the budget section is doing, legislation requires presentment to the governor, passage of a bill by the full legislative assembly, and presentment to the government in the form of a bill to be vetoed or approved. And if a smaller section, just one, not the full legislative assembly, but just a subset of its members, is exercising what amounts to a legislative power, the question is whether that's a legitimate exercise of a legislative function, which is the appropriation of money. And then the other issue that was focused on in these attorney general opinions was whether that was a violation of separation of powers, in that if this is actually a legislative action and it's not presented to the governor in the form of a bill that can be either passed or vetoed, whether that, you know, disrupts one of the checks and balances that the founding fathers put into our system way back at the beginning. Then we have another one in 1991. This one was also, while Attorney General Spaeth, or while Nicholas Spaeth was our Attorney General. And again, it has to do with a provision in a law that required the approval or the oversight of the Budget Section Committee. And again, the long and short of it is that the authority exercised by the Budget Section is comparable to that given to the Board, and it is my opinion that this authority is executive in nature. It is therefore my opinion that when the Budget Section, which is an agent of the legislature, acts in an executive capacity, it violates the separation of powers doctrine. Then we have Attorney General Heitkamp being asked to review something that allows the Budget Section to authorize line item transfers in Section 4 of House Bill 1002. And Attorney General Heitkamp refers back to the two opinions that Attorney General Spaeth had written earlier and basically says, I'm not going to cover that because it's already been covered before. 2007, we have our current Attorney General Wayne Stemgen being asked about the Budget Section's authority to approve or reject a plan to construct or remodel state correctional facilities. And the long and short of that, again, is that Attorney General Stemgen, relying upon past decisions of the other attorney generals, says, no, I think that might be a problem. So we flash forward to the five disputed vetoes that are covered in the case. The first one involved workplace safety, and there's the language of the bill, and the highlighted part is the part that Governor Burgum struck. So we have a larger appropriation of $2.25 million with specific things designated for where that money is going to go, $900 of which was going to be distributed to the three entrepreneurial centers in Bismarck, Fargo, and Grand Forks, and $300 of that to an organization that provides workplace safety. And Governor Burgum decided he didn't want to approve that one specific amount for $300,000 to workplace safety. And so this is the letter that he sent to the President of the Senate indicating that he was going to veto that. Another one involved the School of Nursing, and this actually was a statement that was within the part that was vetoed is the part that says 4 credit hours completed at the school. But it was part of a phrase that was just basically stating the intent of the Legislative Assembly. It is our intent that these general fund appropriations be used for this purpose. And there's a number of cases that talk about one Legislative Assembly not being able to speak for future Legislative Assemblies. So, but very often the legislature still does this so that they give a roadmap for future, you know, this was what we intended when we did this. And there again is Governor Burgum's veto letter that says I'm striking that part of the bill. Another one is the Dickinson State, any portion veto. And that's just that one little phrase is the part that the governor struck, indicating that Dickinson State may not discontinue any portion of its Department of Nursing academic program for the biennium. And Governor Burgum thought that language would cause confusion, and so he notified the Legislative Assembly that he was vetoing that. And the last one of the five involved the Water Commission. Or wait, this is number four, isn't it? I can't count. And there again, you have, there were two of the five that involved the budget section, and this is the first of them. And so there's a general appropriation of almost $300 million to the Water Commission, divided into four different pools for various things: water supply, rural water supply, flood control, and general water. But the second provision there, the second paragraph, says that the Water Commission can transfer stuff if they need to between these pools, but it has to be subject to budget section approval. And Governor Burgum struck that, referring to previous Supreme Court decision, Kelsch, that talked about the non-delegation doctrine, which we'll get into in more detail once we get to the opinion itself. And then the last one is the University School Lands Project veto. And this was a bill that said we're going to give, the legislature said, we're going to give $3.6 million for an IT project. But of that total appropriation, 1.8, half of it has to be spent only upon approval of the budget section. And Governor Burgum struck that language about budget section approval, and again referred back to the same Supreme Court decision that talked about the non-delegation doctrine. So those are the five vetoes. And after these vetoes were made, the Attorney General got asked to express his opinion again by both the Senate and House Majority Leaders. And there's the letter that they sent. And basically, what they were asking were these proper vetoes? And so Attorney General Stemjum sent back a letter opinion expressing his opinion on whether the five vetoes were proper or improper, concluded that the two involving the budget section were improper, because they attempted to strike provision, a condition on appropriation, without striking the entire appropriation itself. And that's a no-no. But he went on to say that, to express an opinion on whether the condition itself was constitutional. And again, referring back to those other provisions or other times when attorney generals had expressed opinions on some legislative functions that were exercised by the budget section, concluded that it would violate the separation of powers doctrine to authorize the budget section to approve or disapprove any transfer of funds by the State Water Commission. Spend only half of the 3.6 appropriated for an IT project. In conclusion, however, he said that courts have consistently held legislatures may validly hold committee hearings and conduct investigations. This is a long-recognized power of the legislature to form study committees and ascertain facts. Therefore, it's my opinion that it's not a violation of the Constitution if the legislative Assembly creates statutory committees to study issues related to different functions. So now we get to the lawsuit itself. After receiving that opinion, the Legislative Assembly still decided to file a lawsuit, or a petition for review, actually, for direct review by the North Dakota Supreme Court, challenging the five vetoes. Now we get to the fun part, and there's a lot here, and I'm obviously there's the opinion is full of rich quotes that I could have picked from, and we're not going to be able to cover everything in an hour. But in the Justice Tufte, in his majority opinion, summarized very well what the overall fight was about, saying first, the Legislative Assembly wants a declaration voiding the five partial vetoes and declaring the bills without the challenge vetoes to be the current law. If that's not granted, seeks, you know, the alternative, a writ of mandamus compelling the governor to treat them as a nullity. And then mentions the governor and attorney general's cross petition regarding the two provisions on that where budget section approval was required before funds could be spent by a state agency. And the court lays out some ground rules, I think, are really just covering territory that had already been covered in previous decisions. And one of those important cases was State Ex Rel Link versus Olson from 1979. And the import of the Olson case is the distinction about the governor's line item veto having the ability to strike particular items or, you know, conditions on it as long as the entire appropriation was struck as well, unless it was something that after that the part struck had to be separate and distinct enough that after removing that specific item, the bill could stand as workable legislation comporting with the fundamental purpose the legislature intended to effect when the whole was enacted. And then the key part there at the end, he may not veto conditions or restrictions on appropriations without vetoing the appropriation itself. The other case that was reaffirmed dates back to 1935. And this involved a challenge to a governor's veto where there were 12 items in total in a particular appropriation for the salaries of the assistant dairy commissioners and the salary of the dairy commissioners, among others, or dairy commissioner, among others. And the governor vetoed all except one of them. That was the salary of the dairy commissioner, which was $3,584 of the total. And part of what was at issue in Sandiger was how did that affect the amounts, the remaining amount. I mean, the bill still said the total, but the effect of the veto was to reduce that total appropriation to just the $3,584 that the governor approved. And what the court said in this case is the veto power is an eraser, not a pencil. In other words, the governor, when he strikes a particular item, he doesn't have to engage in the math. So if we go back to that screen, I'm not going to click through here because I'm not going to be able to get back to the right spot. But if we go back to that one veto involving $2.25 million total, and the governor struck $300,000. What this says is the governor didn't have to go, he could strike the $300,000 and the rest of us could figure out the math. he didn't have to go to the 2.25 and strike that out and reduce it by the amount that he had vetoed. And this is just, this was a principle that was talked about way back in 1935, and our court basically reaffirmed that principle in this case. So let's go to the five vetoes and focus on the language that the Supreme Court addressed on each of them. First, with the workplace safety veto, we have a $300,000 condition or an item that is is this the right screen? Sorry. Oh, yes. We had that $300,000 amount that was part of a bigger $2.25 million. And essentially what the Supreme Court said is that's an appropriate veto. The $300,000 is for a specific item, workplace safety. The governor didn't have to strike $2.25 million and rewrite in $1.9, I can't do the math, but $300,000 less. And that the legislative assembly may not insulate an item from veto by including it within a larger appropriation, funding that larger appropriation from multiple special funds, or failing to identify the funding source for the item. Here it is plain which funds are allocated to which expenditures, so the itemized appropriations each satisfy the required specification of purpose and amount and funding source to identify that this was a specific appropriation. And so they said that veto was a valid one. Now we move on to the credit hour future intent veto. The fight here really focused on, is it because legislative intent is just that, intent, it doesn't do anything more than express a wish or desire, was it inappropriate for the governor to strike that language that was within a statement of legislative intent? And the court answered that question, said yes, the governor cannot do that. The legislative assembly has the prerogative to state its intent in legislation without the governor altering that statement by selectively removing portions. The Water Commission veto, this is one of the ones that involved budget section approval. And so this was a condition on an appropriation. There's almost $300 million appropriated, but transfer of it among funds was subject to budget section approval, was subject to that condition. The governor vetoed just the condition without vetoing the appropriation itself, and so the court said, no, that's an ineffective veto. And then finally, the other veto that involved budget section approval, the court said that's a condition. It's striking a condition on an appropriation without striking the appropriation itself. And so again, that veto is invalid. So at halftime, we have the Legislative Assembly 4 wins, the governor won, with just one of the vetoes being upheld. But, wait, there's more, the second half. We have the cross petition that was filed by the governor. And this was the one that said, well, maybe my veto is invalid, but I still think that condition about the budget section approval violates the Constitution. And so I'm going to challenge that. And kind of as a side here, this isn't about the fight itself, but the Attorney General was the one that brought that cross petition on behalf of the governor, and the Legislative Assembly argued, well, Attorney General is supposed to defend us. The constitutionality of our statutes is at issue, and that's the duty of the Attorney General to defend, not attack it. So they said he may not properly advocate on behalf of the governor against the constitutionality of our statutes. And so the court addressed that because the response was, I'm defending the Constitution. And the court said the Constitution wins. Whenever there's a conflict, the Attorney General's overriding duty is to the Constitution he is sworn to support. So we hold that the Attorney General is not precluded from representing the governor and challenging the constitutionality of a statute. And then we, And then we have State Ex Rel Link v. Olson revisited to some extent. That was also basically a cross petition brought by a governor, in substance the same, where there was ineffective vetoes, but the governor still went on to say, well, maybe my veto was invalid, but I'm still challenging the constitutionality of the provision I vetoed, and the court went on to address that. And you see that. We say, having determined that these vetoes were unauthorized, we must now determine whether or not the part of the law challenge is constitutional. And so the bottom line there is, even when a governor's veto is ineffective because it strikes a condition without striking the corresponding appropriation, the governor can still ask the Supreme Court to review whether the condition itself was constitutional or unconstitutional. And the two big provisions or doctrines that were discussed by the opinion, the first one was the non-delegation doctrine. And I don't have to summarize because Justice Tufte did a really good job of describing what that doctrine means. And that's that the legislative assembly may not delegate to another body the power to make law, to legislate, but it may bestow authority to execute the laws it enacts. In the modern view, that is, in a complex area, it sometimes may be unnecessary and appropriate to delegate in broad and general terms as long as there are adequate standards and procedural safeguards. So in other words, if the safeguards are in the law to begin with, right, that's a legislative act. Someone else, a subset of legislatures, or in some instances the executive branch, is just applying those standards. And one of the previous cases in North Dakota was Stutzman County that involved what the meaning of historical value. The historical board said that it could determine the historical value in order to put something on the state historical registry. And they said that phrase, historic value, has a meaning, and it's sufficient standard that the board is not exercising legislative authority. The legislature already did that by putting in place the standard, and now the board is just applying that law. So the bottom line is, if there's appropriate standards and guidelines, safeguards, for another body to be carrying out, executing a legislative act, that doesn't violate the non-delegation doctrine. Some of the other key statements that the court made in addressing this broader rule. Some of this seems obvious, but it's important to remember the power to make a law is legislative, but the power to administer or execute the law is executive. Power to appropriate is purely a legislative power. And then it talks again about what is specifically an appropriation is, as far as having to have a specification of the amount, the object, and the fund from which the amount is set apart. And so kind of the bottom line is, once the legislature takes act and it performs its legislative function of appropriating money, those dollars fly away and they are to be spent by the executive branch. The power to execute the law is the executive power. But it's only the legislature that can initially make the appropriation. And then the court went on to consider the two different challenge vetoes involving budget section approval. They first reviewed the Water Commission bill. That was, remember that one that says Water Commission gets almost $300 million divided into four pools. It can transfer money between the pools, but it's got to check with the budget section first. And that's all it said. It didn't say it's got to check with the budget section first if condition one, condition two, safeguard three, safeguard four are present. So basically it just said the budget section has complete discretion to approve or disapprove the transfers. And the court said that is not good. A law that provides no safeguards against arbitrary action is a clear sign that the Legislative Assembly has improperly attempted to delegate legislative power. The full legislature has to be the one that can do that, not a subset. And because the Water Commission bill lacked any guidelines, the statute attempted to unlawfully delegate legislative authority to the budget section. Therefore, that bill is unconstitutional and violation of the non-delegation doctrine. Went on to address the University School Lands IT project veto under the non-delegation doctrine, and it similarly held that there were no safeguard standards guidance put in it. It basically said the IT project gets $3.6 million, but $1.8 million has to be approved by the budget section without indicating any standards on how to make that decision, how to exercise that legislative power. So again, the court said the budget section lacks adequate guidance, leaving it discretion to approve or reject the use of $1.8 million appropriated for an IT project, subject only to the budget section's subjective assessment of efficiency achieved or budget savings. Thus, this is a violation of the non-delegation doctrine. And when you think about it from the standpoint of the request for proposal that has to be made by a company who's going to bid the project. Here they've been given this, the universities get this IT project, but we don't know if it's 1.8 or 3.6, and a contractor preparing an RFP would look at it and say, well, how can I tell what is going to be 1.8 or 3.6? Do you want half the watermelon or the whole watermelon, and how am I going to determine? So that's one of the practical problems that arises from this standardless determination of half the amount. After talking about non-delegation, the court went on to address separation of powers, and that had been the focus of those previous Attorney General opinions for the most part. And this is not about a legislature delegating its power to a subset or delegating a power to another entity without appropriate standards that are set forth in law itself. This is about the legislator delegating it to itself or to a subset of its members, a non-legislative function, an executive function, or a judicial function. And that violates what's called the separation of powers doctrine. And the highlighted phrase there sums it up. Under our constitutional system, the legislature may not delegate it to itself or to a subset of its members, executive or judicial functions. And that's part of the balance that the founding fathers saw with the checks and balances put together with the three systems. Some key statements there. This again focuses on something that's pretty basic. Legislatures appropriate and the executive branch executes. So if the legislature is trying to hold on to that power to execute, that violates the separation of powers. It's basically performing an executive function. And it's also not going through, it's an attempt to pass a new law. It wasn't part of the original legislation without presenting it to the governor for his signature, which is required. And the court said, by arrogating to itself through a committee of its members the power to administer appropriations once they've already been made, the legislature has unconstitutionally encroached upon the executive and consolidated power to both make and execute the law into its own hands. This is a violation of the separation of powers. So this is where the opinion gets interesting. When we count votes, the court was unanimous on the non-delegation doctrine. All five justices agreed that both the bills that had budget section approval violated the non-delegation doctrine. So we don't have any issue with that, and the takeaway from that is that you have to have those standards placed in the legislation itself so that the budget section committee has something to go on when it's determining whether or not, for example, the 1.8 of the 3.6 million for the IT project. What are the criteria? What is the historical value, if you want to refer back to Stutzman County? What's the standard that the budget section is applying that the legislature already put in place? But when we get on separation of powers, that's a little more challenging to figure that out. We know that Justice Tufte and Justice Jensen both felt that these two challenged, they signed on to the majority opinion. But Justice VandeWalle wrote separately, and he said, I don't sign on to that part that discusses separation of powers, and he gave us the reason why. I do so because it is unnecessary to our decision, and I'm not convinced the delegation to the budget section, if proper standards were in place, would violate the separation of powers doctrine. Was I a screen behind on you guys? Yeah. That's where Justice VandeWalle said that. And then Justice Crothers wrote a separate decision that was also joined by McEvers and VandeWalle. And what he says is, and this is kind of a general doctrine that is usually followed by courts, our court and other courts, that we want to decide things on the narrowest grounds possible. And Justice Crothers said that he believed the non-delegation doctrine was a narrower ground to determine this issue than separation of powers. And so he said we should have just stopped when we got to that. But what's interesting about this and what makes it hard to count votes is he never expressed an opinion. He never says what, you know, if I had decided, and we're not, courts aren't supposed to do that either, right? We don't want them issuing advisory opinions. So we don't know his position. We don't know Justice McEvers' position if they had actually had to decide the separation of powers, which leaves it an open question. And if you look back at Justice VandeWalle, the reason I have the question mark on the one that represents his vote in the middle is he just said, I'm not convinced. So I think what he's saying there is I'd need to see the facts of the case, the law itself that's being challenged, to determine whether something might violate the separation of powers. So what we have at the end is the final score. The governor made up some ground. Despite the fact that his budget section vetoes were invalid, the point he was trying to make was recognized, that the budget section violates the separation of powers doctrine. So final score, Legislative Assembly 2, Governor 3. What did the legislature do in response? It passed. ND sent code 543502.9. This talks about the budget section, what the membership is going to be. And by the way, I didn't include this on a slide, but if you're interested, you can go to the Legislative Assembly's website, and they have different sections that describe their different committees. And the budget section committee actually has about, you know, and it doesn't go through point by point these individual statutes that require budget section approval, but the budget section is very involved, and it, again, stems back to we're practical people. We have a biennial legislature. There are certain things that come up during those 2 years, and we need to address them. So they have, I want to say, almost 30 different duties that are laid out of things that they're supposed to do and report back to the legislature between the biennial sessions. But in this case, what the Legislative Assembly sought to do is to put in place some standards and guidelines for when the budget section is acting. And they did this in this kind of one-size-fits-all. Instead of going and finding all those different 21 different provisions that require budget section approval, they wanted to handle it all with this one statute. And there are the eight conditions or safeguards or standards that they put in place that we're going to always apply. The request has to be for a specific purpose, specific amount of funds, specific time frame, must conform with legislative intent, be consistent with related statutory provisions, support state priorities, improve state efficiencies, must not extend beyond the current biennium if it's for a new program or addresses an emergency. And so the question about will there be a sequel, it could come up in a number of ways. Someone could challenge those standards and say, well, that's not sufficient. Or someone could say, yeah, the standards are sufficient, but so we're not dealing with a non-delegation problem, but we still believe that even with those standards in place, this would be a violation of the separation of powers doctrine by having the legislature basically trying to perform through the budget section an executive function. I hope I didn't go too fast. I see I have a little bit of time left. I don't know if there are any questions.
Thank you, Logan. Thanks, Jim. How do you read that case in light of the Emergency Commission's actions over the past 3 months?
Good question. I didn't come to talk about anything involving the Emergency Commission. I think that's a topic for a whole other day. And to get into the weeds. The Emergency Commission is a commission that's set up to deal with some of those emergencies that come up when the legislature is not in session. And usually the legislature says, well, we might have these emergencies come up. We're going to set this money aside. And traditionally, the legislative or the Emergency Commission was comprised of a mix of both executive branch members and legislative branch members, so it was a mixed body, so that it wasn't the legislature basically delegating to a subset of its members. It was a mixed group. I'm sorry to dodge the question, but I think that's a whole other can of worms, and I just wanted to focus on the case for today. Sorry. And by the way, that brings up another topic. You know, if I say anything right today, Wayne gets full credit, Seth gets full credit. If I say anything wrong, it comes with this disclaimer: these are just my opinions and not the official opinion of the Attorney General's office.
Any more questions for Jim? Any online questions? Thank you very much for being here today.
Yep, thank you.